Heads up, fans of the world. We're putting a little something extra in your feed. Things That Go Boom, a bonus podcast to loyal listeners of the world from PRX. Things That Go Boom. Let's roll.
February 19th. It's a totally normal post-President's Day week. I kick off work a little early for my son Arlo's science fair at preschool, which is adorable. He's four, and his project is, no joke, called Things That Go Bam. After the fair, my husband Mark and I go out to celebrate a late Valentine's Day at Ida B's in Baltimore. And as it turns out, it's our last date night for a while.
There is some new information on the deadly coronavirus outbreak.
As the death toll continues to rise,
people in Wuhan have been asked not to leave the city, and outsiders have been told to stay away.
February 24th, my parents return from a Caribbean cruise to celebrate Mardi Gras with my sister in New Orleans. They FaceTime us from a packed bar on Bourbon Street.
Fears are growing that it won't be possible to stop the global spread of coronavirus.
I have risk to the American people remains very low. People die from the flu. View this the same as the flu.
February 27th. I go out for a run. I turn on the daily
and Michael Barbaro.
They talk about the 1918 flu.
If things don't change, a lot of us might die.
I feel the first shudder of fear. I can't sleep.
You know, it could get worse before it gets better. It could maybe go away. We'll see what happens. Nobody really knows.
February 29th, Mark and I take our son Arlo to a pop-up party for one of his favorite podcasts. We're scared to touch the railings at the theater. We tell Arlo not to touch things.
At this moment, we have 22 patients in the United States currently that have coronavirus. Unfortunately, one person passed away overnight. Additional cases in the United States are likely.
March 2nd, Mark brings home a few extra supplies. Pasta, beans.
Resources are stretched thin and only the critically ill are being taken to the hospital.
Today, health officials in Washington state announced four new deaths.
And warned this could be the tip of the iceberg.
I tweet in all caps, I can't stop touching my face.
I haven't touched my face in weeks. In weeks. I miss it.
March 5th. I break down crying just before bed. I tell Mark I'm so scared. He thinks I'm crazy, but he's nice about it.
Flights are being canceled. Trade shows are being called off. Businesses are restricting.
Today I am officially declaring a national emergency. Two very big words.
March 15th. A local brewery holds a huge event and posts it on Instagram. I'm so frustrated that I write an angry note. Please, I beg you, move to pickup only.
We're going to win. And I think we're going to win faster than people think, I hope.
March 16th. Schools are closed. Toilet paper is gone. We stay home. We all need haircuts already.
On Wall Street, it was another wild week.
Empty shelves where toilet paper, hand sanitizer, along with some meats and water should be.
Over-the-counter medicines vanishing from a Target.
The airline industry is projected to lose $113 billion.
March 21st. Our friends who raise pigs are going out of business. We buy a giant box of pig and stack it end to end in our freezer. It barely fits.
We're hearing from emergency room staff who say they will soon run out of supplies.
More than Italy, dozens of towns are under lockdown.
April 9th, my son's preschool closes for good. They won't make it out of the crisis.
Where are the ventilators?
Be on alert. There was an infected case that might have been in the vicinity.
Where are the gowns?
The new coronavirus spreads through droplets in
the
air.
Where's
the PPE? When infected people.
Where are the masks?
Fears are growing. Wall Street crater today as major indexes.
Where are they?
I'm Lacey Healy, and we're back with a new season of Things That Go Boom, your friendly neighborhood national security podcast from Inkstick Media and PRX. And just like you, we've all been kind of sideswiped by COVID-19. It crept up slowly in plain sight, and still, here we are. Feeling anxious, uncertain, and unsafe. At Things That Go Boom, though, we think a lot about what keeps us safe. And usually those thoughts are pretty focused on big, obvious threats. Things like bombs. After all, that's the most obvious thing that goes boom. But it seems even more clear now, it's not the only thing. We spend billions and billions of dollars on defense. And yet, the coronavirus slipped silently and invisibly across our borders.
People had already traveled home for the holidays, possibly bringing the virus with them.
And even onto our aircraft carriers.
A sailor from the aircraft carrier, the USS Theodore Roosevelt, has died from coronavirus-related complications.
You can say we were preparing for World War III when we got hammered by World War C. So this season, we're asking a simple question. What else are we missing? Staying safe is about preparing for the threats that face us, the ones that we're expecting and the ones that catch us off guard. For an idea of what it means to be truly prepared, we talked to Alden Wicker.
I'm extremely organized and I like to have everything laid out in front of me, especially when it's something sort of big and massive.
Normally, Alden would have been in a recording studio or radio station, but it's the time of Corona. So she was in her living room and I was interviewing her from my recording studio.
I love your closet. Looks so organized.
Otherwise known as my closet.
This is like a little bit of like...
Looks like jersey cotton.
Like a jersey cotton with a little bit of stretch.
Alden knows a lot about clothes.
I am a sustainable fashion journalist and expert, and I live in Brooklyn.
Here's what else you need to know about Alden. She's an expert planner, and this story might seem a little quirky. Just stay with me. She has a spreadsheet for everything. Even cities she and her husband want to visit. That one includes columns for the number of days they want to spend in each place, the country code, the cost of living there. You get the picture. Then coronavirus came. Scary, yes, but no match for Alden. She was early to the game. And there wasn't a lot of stockpiling advice out there. So she sent out a tweet, a call for help.
I was like, where are all the fancy recipe blogs with their like non-perishable recipes for people who eat kale?
That didn't work, but she did find this one website.
This website that was like beautifully organized, very ugly, but beautifully organized.
Ugly as in bare bones. There was a pixelated American flag in one corner.
And then down below, there's this really old style GIF of like a letter going into a mail slot, you know, like email me.
So that was a little off. But there was something about this website that Alden found appealing.
It had this like beautiful spreadsheet with like how many cans of this proteins you need and how many cans of vegetables and like what sauces you need. And then it had recipes. A lot of these recipes are like, take one can of this kind of soup, take another can of this kind of soup, put it together.
Can you tell me about some of the recipes actually? Is that like, are there some in particular that you remember?
So there's one dessert called the double-decker salty Nutella sandwich.
Oh.
And it involves saltine crackers, a can of cherries and syrup, almonds, and a jar of Nutella. And I would probably eat this on a normal day if I was feeling emotional. So I was like, great, that's going on the list.
So Alden and her husband pulled out the big bin they used to pack up stuff for Burning Man, the Burning Man bin, and started stockpiling. And in the middle of all this, something happened.
So there was a moment where I was reading all of the recipes to my husband and saying, like, stop me if any of these sound disgusting. And so I was reading them off and there was something like Millennium Chowder and then there was like Millennium something else. And he was like, why is everything called Millennium? And I was like, I don't know. And then I looked at the top of the website and it's a Y2K prepper website.
Y2K. As in the year 2000 computer glitch that was going to shut down power grids and wipe out all our bank accounts. It was also called the Millennium Bug, but actually it ended up being a Millennium Fizzle.
So it's like everything is 20 years old.
Oh my gosh.
So she was prepared, but she was prepared for the wrong apocalypse. A lot of defense experts would tell you that Alden's Burning Man bin, bursting with 20-year-old recipes and food she'll never eat, isn't a bad analogy for the way we plan our national security strategy. We spend over $700 billion on defense every year. That's about a sixth of our overall budget, more than healthcare, education, and all of the rest of our discretionary spending combined. A lot of that money goes to things like maintaining our nuclear weapons, buying aircraft carriers and fighter jets, and, you know, fighting wars, big and small. But we pay our defense contractors like rock stars. Sometimes we buy $10,000 toilet covers and $85 million instruction manuals. And for a while now, the sky has sort of been the limit on what we're willing to spend on defense. And part of the reason we spend so much money has to do with some really old ideas on what war even is. It seems like an eternity now, but a few months ago, when we could all still gather in large groups, I went to a national security conference for folks who work in and around the defense industry, an event associated with the publication of the same name called Defense One 2020. And while I was there, I noticed the words great power competition like a rash all over the panel descriptions. That's this phrase that's been floating around Washington to the point where it's almost become a cliche. So I asked folks what it means. But the answers were a little mushy.
What do we mean when we say great power competition?
I think the entire community, the national security and defense community, is very much struggling with that.
But I think we should probably really look at it through the lens of competition.
And recognizing that those people with which we have some level of adversarial relationship, we need to deal with.
Cyberspace, of space, et cetera, et cetera.
To something bigger.
Which is to say, have more, bigger, faster than any other country in the world.
It's a good thing you guys edit this.
DIME, right? The diplomatic, information, military, economic.
Something along those lines.
Basically, for most of the last century, the U.S. lived in a world where big, great power rivalries took center stage. World War I, World War II, the Cold War. It was us against them. And them mostly meant other big countries. Then 9/11 happened.
And night fell on a different world.
And the war on terror began.
A world where freedom
and terrorism didn't have a home.
Under attack.
It was everywhere.
There are thousands of these terrorists in more than 60 countries.
And suddenly we thought, maybe this is what we do now.
We will rally the world to this cause by our efforts, by our courage. We will not falter, and we will not fail.
And maybe world wars are a thing of the past. Then there was another shift.
Well, good morning, and thank you all for taking time to...
In 2018, in unveiling a new national defense strategy, the Secretary of Defense at the time, General Jim Mattis, cemented the words that had just begun to show up in strategy documents the year before.
We will continue to prosecute the campaign against terrorists that we're engaged in today, but great power competition, not terrorism, is now the primary focus of U.S. national security.
The whole thing didn't exactly come out of the blue.
The world, to quote George Shultz, is awash in change.
China had been building military outposts on contested coral reefs in the South China Sea, and Vladimir Putin had illegally annexed Crimea.
With great power competition between nations becoming a reality once again.
General Mattis and many others drew a logical conclusion. Great power competition was the new black. But a lot of defense folks are still very divided on what exactly this competition thing even means. Is it economic, technological? Is it military? Are we headed to another world war? I asked Kathleen Hicks, who directs the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in D.C., to help me understand the current state of affairs. And she described our current national security roadmap like this.
Here's the best one I can come up with. It's the episode of The Office where Michael and Dwight...
Oh, right. Turn.
...follow the GPS system in the car.
No, look. It means go up to the right, bear right, over the bridge, and hook up with 307.
Make a right.
Maybe it's
turn.
A shortcut, Dwight. It said go to the right.
It can't mean that. There's
look,
a lake right there.
I think he knows where it is going.
And go into a lake. And I think this is sort of where we are. We have this roadmap kind of the Cold War. It doesn't exactly work, but we don't know what else to follow. And we don't really know where it's going. There isn't a plan, but it seems like it's right. And it's following some kind of vague sentiment about what's been wrong in the past. And where do we end up? You know, we end up with the car in a lake.
Hicks says she doesn't really like the term great power competition.
It's a throwback, if you will, term to an era in which you had a number of states that are of roughly equal power stature who are competing for power and influence.
But she's clear on who our two main rivals are.
Today's great power competition focus is primarily on China and secondarily on Russia, two countries that have very different profiles. Russia is a declining power, but that doesn't necessarily make it less dangerous. In fact, it may make it more dangerous because there's incentive to gamble for significant payoff early and quickly. And so the Russians are the most opportunistic in terms of disinformation, obviously coming after the U.S. election process.
Should we be thinking of China as a threat?
Yeah, I think we should be thinking about China as a threat, but the difference is we shouldn't be thinking of China only as a threat. The Chinese are not on an inevitable rise to be the superpower of the future, and the United States is not on an inevitable decline.
To be fair, our adversaries have been building a whole lot of big weapons. China only spends about a third of what the U.S. does in its military. But that spending also rose by 83% between 2009 and 2018. So it's bulking up. And Russia, well, it spends a whole lot less. But as we learned during the 2016 election, Russia can be creative with what it has. So I asked the folks at the Defense One conference what they saw as the biggest threat that we face. Was it hypersonic missiles? An incident in the South China Sea?
And what is the greatest national security threat that we face today?
Climate change.
Climate change.
Yes.
Divisiveness within the United States, and I think that is the biggest threat to us and our democracy.
They did not say hypersonic missiles. In fact, some were a little worried that we might be putting too much time and money into military solutions.
We started to let, you know, economic and political levers, even like the information lever of power, kind of atrophy. You know, the military is an easy button in some senses. So I think that we've got to kind of walk that back, which I feel like a heretic for saying that.
The military instrument power in great power competition should be both very small and in support of the others, rather what it's doing right now, which is kind of leading the way.
This kind of talk isn't completely unheard of. In fact, General Mattis also famously said that, quote, if you don't fund the State Department fully, then I need to buy more ammunition. But coming from defense folks, it was still a surprise. Hicks was sure to note that we can't discount the value of a strong military. That's not what this is about.
I mean, I would hate for anyone to come away with the thought that we've got that covered and all we have to worry about are these other elements of power. We are in a walk and chew gum situation.
But she agrees that right now, we're chewing a lot more than we're walking.
The balance has tilted so far away from having civilian capacity and capability that it's really becoming quite apparent that we increasingly rely on our military, in part because it's the only thing that we've kept relatively healthy and funded. And if we just keep doing that and keep allowing those civilian capacities to atrophy, we're not going to have the kind of toolkit we need to deal with the challenges of the future.
And just think about these statements now. According to some calculations, we could buy 2,200 ventilators for the price of one F-35. And just 1 year of spending on nuclear weapons could provide 300,000 ICU beds, 35,000 ventilators, and 75,000 doctor salaries. In 2019, before any of us had even heard of COVID-19, Hicks took part in a simulation, like a virtual war game.
Sometimes you have things like a fake news real run, or you'll have a board, literally like a Risk game board, or even a computerized version of that that sets a scene. In this case, what we had was a paper. Would it be helpful if I read a little bit of the setup?
Sure, sure. That would be great.
So the way we opened up was to say, the World Health Organization declared a public health emergency of international concern on January 4, 2025, as infection rates of a SARS, MERS-like coronavirus
sound familiar?
800 million globally, killing 25 million.
So Hicks wasn't exactly surprised when the coronavirus upended our lives.
Few countries have been left unaffected by the outbreak, and the global economy has dipped into recession.
She'd been through it once before. Well, kind of. What did surprise her was how totally ineffectual governments were. The lack of clear communication, the lack of international cooperation, the lack of medical equipment.
and the way we plan for crises is often around a clear culminating point, an invasion across, you know, a border or an explosion occurs. In reality, what we see is the international environment doesn't give us that crystal clear point. We always worry about bolts out of the blue. But when you're denied that culminating point, and this pandemic is a perfect example of this, and instead when it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds.
March 5th, I break down crying just before bed.
March 15th.
We all need haircuts already.
Schools are closed.
March 16th.
Toilet paper is gone.
I tell Mark I'm so scared. We stay home.
In many ways, that's harder for us. And by the time it's at a crisis point, it's been underway for months.
This season on Things That Go Boom, we ask what other kinds of security risks are building out there. We'll look at misinformation and shadow warfare, and we'll even ask if democracy, this thing we're working to protect, is still in vogue. But we'll also try to keep in mind that history can teach us valuable lessons. After all, Alden, that amazing planner we met earlier, might have stockpiled for the wrong apocalypse, but prepping all those Y2K recipes had a silver lining. It reminded her of her grandmother.
I grew up eating recipes that always started with a box of Bisquick because it's similar to how my grandmother cooked for us all the time. So
yeah.
I feel like I could easily go back to that. And can I cuss?
You can. Yes, you totally can. This is a podcast.
When the shit hits the fan, like, I want to know that I have ingredients created for the era of Cold War bunkers. So, yeah.
So you want something like solid.
Yeah.
Things That Go Boom will be back every 2 weeks this season. Good news, since we hope this new schedule might allow us to check in with you all a whole lot more moving forward. Next time, we'll look back a bit to see how China's rise snuck upon us.
The answer to the question, has China won, is not yet.
Things That Go Boom is produced by Inkstick Media and distributed by PRX. Our show is produced by Ruth Morris, Marin Lazian, and me, with help from Helena DeGroot. Darian Schulman composes our music, and our engineer is Robin Wise. A huge thank you to John Barth for his editorial support. Also, thank you to John Blocker, Dave Ahern, Mia Harrington, Larry Rubin, and the rest of the folks who shared their personal views with me at the Defense One Summit. If you're interested in sustainable fashion, definitely check out Alden's stories. You can find her at aldenwicker.com. And thanks to the Carnegie Corporation of New York, MacArthur Foundation, and N Square for continuing to make our show possible.
So there's Dijon potato salad. Love potato salad. Grandmother used to make it all the time. It involves a can of potatoes, dried onions, chopped jerky, and then some, you know, like Dijon vinegar, oil, tarragon, things like that,
Yeah.
which sounds edible.